The Pacifica Quartet recently won their second Grammy Award for their recording called Contemporary Voices. It features three pieces, each of which was written specifically for the quartet. I talked with violist Mark Holloway recently about what it was like to win the Grammy Award and how this project really was a labor of love for the quartet. That's what you'll hear about this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Mocker. Mark, let's start off by just finding out who you are and how you found your way into the world of the viola.
Well, I'm Mark Holloway. I'm violist of the Pacifica Quartet, and I started playing viola at the age of 8 in public school. We had a pretty robust public music program in our elementary schools. I'm sure that's not the case now, because we were so fortunate. And so I think I knew what a viola was, but there was something about the name I liked better, that it just had a nice ring to it, viola. And I knew that the violin often had the melody and was more the superstar, maybe, or the highest voice. And I think I found it interesting to be inside and to be sort of influencing from the inside, perhaps, as a team player or a partner. And yeah, I think that I was drawn to the viola. I was drawn to that role. And I had terrific teachers when I was growing up in the public schools in Long Island, New York. And now we keep in touch. We're Facebook friends. If I play in New York, they come to my concerts. It's pretty extraordinary.
Your teachers? Your former teachers?
Yeah, just a year or two ago, I was playing with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, and a stagehand sort of ran backstage and said, "Is Mark Holloway here? There's someone here to speak with him. Her name is Mrs. Hamilton." And I said, "What?" And it was my elementary school string teacher, who was, my first viola teacher that I hadn't had any contact with in the last 15 years. She had seen my name in a program or something and bought a ticket. And so here I was, I just played a concert for my first viola teacher without even knowing it. And she came up at intermission, and it was just lovely to see her. And my middle school teacher was incredibly influential, and we're Facebook friends, and we keep in touch, and they're excited for the things I'm doing. And I had a high school math teacher who was extremely interested in music and in concerts and in art. And he used to take students into New York City, which is a 30 or 40 minute train ride from where I grew up, to see the New York Philharmonic, to see the ballet. We would go out for Thai food. This was the 1990s. I had never had Thai food before. And then it just so happened that I went to Tanglewood as a student, and they happened to have a summer home right near Tanglewood. And so we became even closer, and we're still extremely close. And so I had a great public school education, and I'm still in touch with some of the people who really influenced me.
What did your elementary school teacher say when she came backstage? I mean, I have to imagine she must have been bursting with pride.
Oh, well, I hope so. That would be a very nice feeling. I think we were both a little speechless. My reaction actually was that she looked so much younger than I remembered. When you're a student, when you're in third grade or fourth grade, you think the teacher is much older than you, but she was a very young teacher, I'm sure. And it was lovely to see her. I mean, I think we both were just, appreciating each other. Of course, this is before the pandemic, when these sorts of interactions would mean, so much more now, perhaps, since we've been, separated from friends and loved ones.
Tell me how you came to be part of the Pacifica Quartet.
Well, it's sort of a funny story because the music world, the chamber music world, is a little bit of a small one in the sense that we know each other. We went to this festival together. We went to this school together. We studied with this teacher together. And so as you sort of fan out in the world, you still have this extraordinary community of friends and colleagues and musicians to call on. But I didn't actually know the members of the Pacifica Quartet. We had never crossed paths. And so I just got an email one day saying that they were looking for a violist. And, would I consider, reading with them? Would I be interested in something like this? And I was living in New York City, and I was a freelancer. I was playing a lot with several groups sort of regularly, but I didn't have a job, so to speak. I played quite a bit with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, and then for many years as a guest with the New York Philharmonic and the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra and the American Ballet Theater and New York City Ballet and on and on and on. And I was sort of ready for a change. Chamber music was always my enormous passion, which I discovered at Tanglewood. That's another story I like to tell because it was so meaningful to me that summer there. And they just asked, you know, would I be interested in? In fact, I was looking for something a little more stable, something where I could, instead of playing with different people every week, which is thrilling, in one way, to be able to build on something sort of day after day that accumulates into something that's perhaps more polished, or you can dig more deeply, you know, when you're examining the same thing over and over. And when you're in a string quartet, of course, there's a vast repertoire, but you also return to the classics. And so it's a real privilege to get to play this great music with such depth, and to have time to tune things and to really get them well together, and to come up with a conception and a flow and a pacing that you don't always have the time for when you're, you know, you have four rehearsals, let's say, and then the concerts, and then that's it, you say goodbye. And it just so happens that in the freelance chamber music world, that's not to say it's some scrappy scene. You know, part of the great skill of a chamber musician is listening and knowing how to react to someone, how to accompany someone, how to play a solo when you're surrounded by this kind of, you know, these kinds of players, or those kinds of players, or this kind of concert hall, or, and to make quick adjustments. And so that's something that really, I think, helped me as a musician. I think I learned a lot of those things. It made me a little more adept on the viola. But it's a different skill set, perhaps, when you're playing with different people every week, which is great. It really feels like a family. You know, you'll see someone you haven't seen in 6 months, but yet I went to school with them. I went to this festival. I went to that festival. I know their families, you know, et cetera. It's a real joy to be a chamber musician because of the relationships you can forge, because it's such an intimate art form. You have to be very vulnerable, I think, when you're playing with other people. And so you learn a lot, but also you share a lot.
That's really interesting, that vulnerable piece. Not everybody's willing to do that.
It's very hard, I have to say. I think we're extremely lucky to do what we do. It's like being, how do I say it? It's like working in an art museum, except if you worked at an art museum, you would appreciate the Rembrandt from afar, or maybe close up, you could look at it, but you can't touch it. You can't swap out this brown for that brown and try a different frame on it or whatever. But when we're playing Beethoven, I feel like I'm looking at it on the page and I'm trying to make it come to life the best I can. And so I get to sort of have my hands in it day after day, these extraordinary masterpieces, and masterpieces that are being written now that, you know, I'm not even sure if they're masterpieces yet. You know, they need time for the dust to settle. But it's a real privilege to be able to sort of work with it. It's like a baker working with dough or something.
I want to ask you more about that. First, though, I want you to tell me what it means to the Pacifica Quartet to be artists in residence at Indiana University.
It's an extraordinary privilege to pass on the things we know to students. All of the dark clouds that there are in the world today, I don't see them in my students. They're so smart and interested and curious and open-minded and trying to make the world a more beautiful place. It's very inspiring. And I had amazing teachers who were not just good musicians, but good people. And I think it's very satisfying to pass on the great things I've learned from such remarkable musicians. I really do feel like I'm in a line of succession, let's say, of musicians who learned from great musicians, and I'm trying to pass on what I know. And it's harder now because there's a lot of distraction. You know, if you go to YouTube and type in Beethoven, you'll find 500,000 different recordings. That wasn't the case 20 years ago, 30 years ago. In one way, that's a fantastic thing. There's so much more to absorb, to learn from, to be inspired by. And part of what we do, an important part, is sort of narrative, you know, trying to tell a story. And I feel like that one-to-one connection that we have as teachers with our students is a really great medium for that. So to be in residence in Indiana, it has such a strong music program with extremely talented students, and we feel that the art form of chamber music, of string quartet playing, is something worth preserving and expanding and passing on. So we teach our instruments individually, and also we coach chamber music. We, you know, run the string chamber music program. And so it's our way to sort of pass on what we've learned to these students who, it's a real important age for them, because they're just learning perhaps to play with other musicians their age. You know, perhaps they grew up in a small town and only played in the orchestra, let's say, in their high school, if they were even lucky to have, you know, lucky enough to have one. And now it's their chance to really figure out what they love about music. Is it solo playing? Is it orchestral playing? Is it chamber music? And, you know, learning to listen is a real important part of playing chamber music. And so it's my job as a teacher to sort of help them learn how to listen.
Congratulations on the Grammy Award that Pacifica Quartet won for Best Chamber Music Performance. What does that feel like to win a Grammy Award?
Well, thanks very much. I mean, as I think about it now, I sort of even get the chills a little bit. It was just a real honor to be nominated, for someone to recognize what you're doing. And in our case, it's just, you know, our peers in the industry. So it's incredibly gratifying that they think what you're doing is maybe important or beautiful or, you know, whatever they think. And that was that. I never expected to win. You know, my quartet had already won a Grammy for Elliot Carter string quartets, you know, before I joined the quartet. And so I don't think we expected to win, especially because there were, you know, such other terrific nominees in the field. And because of the pandemic, we were watching separately because we were still, you know, distancing and wearing masks and everything when we were rehearsing. So the telecast or the webcast of the Grammys, you couldn't wear a mask. And so we had to be separate, you know, to find out. And so I was in my studio at the Jacobs School of Music in Bloomington, Indiana, just watching along as they announced it. And I just sort of froze when they said it. You know, the instructions were to speak right away when they announced your name. And so, you know, the first violinist, Samin, was the one to sort of speak. And we were all sort of shocked and we couldn't believe it. And that was that. Then it was on to the next category and I was left sort of, you know, sitting there astounded. Yeah, it was incredible.
Have you had a chance to celebrate since?
Yeah. Luckily, we're all vaccinated now. And so now we're able to rehearse and perform without masks and we're able to sit closer together. And so we've celebrated. I've celebrated with friends. And I just think everyone's in the mood to celebrate something right now. If we've weathered this difficult storm okay, then we're celebrating now that we can see each other and connect again and enjoy each other's company. And it just means even more now.
Not only did you win a Grammy Award for this recording, Contemporary Voices, it was also a labor of love for you and the quartet. Can you explain why?
Well, this was music that was written for the quartet. When you commission a piece or when a piece arrives at your doorstep, you never know what you're going to get because no one's heard it before. You're just looking at the music, trying to imagine what it might sound like. And of course, when you're working with composers that are such esteemed composers like Ellen Tafes Willick, Jennifer Higdon, and Shulamit Ron, you know, you don't worry about the music not being terrific. They're all, you know, Pulitzer Prize-winning composers. But it was written for the quartet, and it was music that we had a close relationship with. And we thought it might be nice that just spoke to us to record something from here and from now. And it turned out, I mean, not, you know, because we recorded this, I suppose, early 2019, you know, before the pandemic, you know, we had any idea this sort of thing might happen. And then it turned out that these three pieces just sort of speak so well to the time right now. It's extraordinary. It's I can relate so much to these three pieces after having gone through this pandemic. Each one has something quite unique to say.
The recording itself takes the listener on an emotional journey, and it starts with the world premiere recording of Glitter Doom Shard's Memory, and that's the String Quartet No. 3 by Shulamit Ron. You guys commissioned this piece, and the visual arts became the seed for the creation of this work. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes. There was an exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in the mid-2000s. That was entitled Glitter and Doom, German Portraits from the 1920s. And I think this was an inspiration to Shulamit. The quartet was in residence at the museum then, and so they wanted to play some music that had some connection to the visual arts. And we knew Shulamit from being in residence at the University of Chicago, where she's Professor Emerita. So this is before my time. They had worked together there and knew each other, and they wanted to have a piece from her that had something to do with the visual arts. And so she was inspired by this exhibition. There's a German Jewish painter named Felix Nussbaum who perished in Auschwitz in the Holocaust. he painted, you know, in the camps. He painted during the war. I mean, you know, he painted. He kept on painting, and so this struggle to survive, to create, to express, to identify, was a really powerful one. The first movement talks about the ordinary life, everyday life. It has its beauties, its ups and downs, the sweet sense of normalcy I remember her talking about. And the second movement is a little bit like a scherzo. And it's machine-like, and it's relentless. And we hear the mechanisms of the machinery of war, of Nazism, of, you know, what have you, in the rhythmic precision. And at the very end, there's even a waltz-like little tune, and someone in the quartet has to whistle. This simple tune that somebody might whistle, yet they might be doing something chilling at the same time, like, you know, the smile, the grimace on the face of the executioner, I think Shulamit said. So I think that's a really chilling juxtaposition. The third movement starts with a quotation from Nussbaum himself. "If I perish, do not let my paintings die." He kept on painting in Auschwitz until his death in 1944. I think it's the emotional heart of the quartet. And it's also something really interesting compositionally, is that it's not all composed out precisely. You might have little cells of notes that you play after someone else plays a certain cell of other notes. And, you know, they might play two notes and then you quickly respond right afterwards. But it's not metered. So there's a little bit of an element of improvisation in it, which makes it very personal, I think, and also very different from performance to performance, because it's how you're feeling at the moment, you know, how your heart is beating in that moment. It, you know, affects how you play it. She talks about the power of creating something. I mean, I find that difficult every day, even though I'm not really creating, I'm just interpreting. But the fact that someone under such stress and such cruelty could still have the will to create and do something so beautiful, that's extremely inspiring. The last movement is called Shard's Memory, which is what she thought would be left over after such a, you know, cataclysmic event, that, you know, there are shards left that you have to put back together, and, you know, if you hope to go on. And what we remember from the past, from the people who were, from the things that were created, you know, it's a very strong sense of memory, and I think we can take comfort in that we have memory of what happened. It's also how we remember people like Felix Nussbaum. I mean, if you look for his paintings, you can look them online. There's one which is called, I think it's called Self-Portrait with Jewish Identity Card. I mean, you could imagine, just that title is so chilling. But I mean, he was a person, and there were millions like him who were snuffed out. So I think remembering someone like Felix Nussbaum is a way of sort of restoring their dignity, which was sort of just ripped from them. I don't know, I find incredible connections between then and now. You know, refugees, war, hatred. It's incredibly powerful. I mean, everything has changed so much in the last year or two, but the power of his paintings remains, I think. I encourage you to, you know, find this haunting painting online. You know, sort of lessons to take from the past and hope for the future. And Jennifer Higdon's piece kind of opens with this blitz, you know, fury of chaos. It it's a real explosion right at the beginning. You know, I think Jennifer was saying that a lot of pieces sort of start out soft and end loud and end with a big bang, and she wanted to see what it might be like the other way around. So that's what she does. And as the piece goes through its life, it transforms and changes. It becomes more expressive. It sort of opens its heart to more ideas, and things slow down. So the first movement is called Blitz, like I said. The second movement is called Soft and Lacing. Soft and Lacing, it's a really beautiful title for a movement, I think. It's much calmer, it's more expressive, there's more sort of, you know, throbbing heartbeats and glimpses of sounds and of, you know, shadows that come and go. Again, moving towards something else, which is the last movement called Grace. And it flows in one giant movement, the whole piece. And Grace, I think Jennifer was talking about what that word connotes. It could be a graceful expression, or the way that you move elegantly, or what you say at the table, you know, surrounded by your family, if you're particularly religious, let's say. Something that moves quietly and elegantly. And then it ends just in a wisp of a hopeful chord, and it's very peaceful and calming, and it's a really remarkable piece.
The piece on this recording that kind of surprised me the most is the one by Ellen Taves-Willick, the quintet for alto saxophone and string quartet. I was actually really kind of stunned at how beautiful the saxophone and the string quartet sounded together. And this isn't a combination that you hear every day, is that true?
Yeah, I too was sort of unsure at what it would sound like, because I've never really played with saxophone except in orchestra. But, you know, with an artist like Otis Murphy, especially, there's a wide, wide range, you know, wide palette of colors and sounds and dynamics and articulations. So I found it really inspiring to try to find sounds that would go together. There were a lot of times when, like, I had to play with Otis, let's say, we'd have the same exact thing, and so I'd have to try to blend my sound into his. I think it was a challenge to record because of the amount of sound and the way the sound comes out of the saxophone. So for the recording, we actually had to sit kind of apart and facing in different directions. And so the synchronization was quite challenging, especially in the second movement, which is fast and often with the same rhythm. It's very jazzy. Very quick changes and quick rests where you have to play immediately afterwards together. It's very, very difficult.
One of the things the composer said about this work is that it gives each player a chance to be a virtuoso soloist at one moment, and then in the next moment you have to be a sensitive partner. Did you find that to be true as well?
Absolutely. I would say that's true in most music, especially as we get closer to our own day. And I do think there's something in common with the saxophone, with the human voice, with the viola. You could say that, of course, about the cello, about the violin. Every instrument claims to be closer to the human voice, and they're all right. with this piece, it's true. There were often sort of duos and solos for each instrument. The saxophone doesn't always dominate, let's say, as you think it might. It's also a team player, and so that's a special quality as a composer, to be able to write so well so it blends at the same time that there are moments of emergence. We often think about music, you know, when we're rehearsing something, you know, which is the first voice, which is the primary voice we have to hear, which is the secondary voice here, to make sure that the audience is hearing the score as we'd like it to be heard, to make sure that that we understand that this is a melodic line, this is a counter melody, this is an accompaniment, this is a duo, this is a trio. So, and we change these things in different concert halls, depending on how dry or how resonant they are. And for sure on recordings, we want to make sure that the things that we want to come out a certain way come out. And so a piece like this was really interesting and a fun challenge to try to get the balance just right, so it would sound like how we wanted it to. And sometimes it's just a big old party, you know, everyone's playing together, making a lot of fun noise, so to speak, because there's a lot of joy in this piece. There's a lot of lyricism and also a lot of joy. Just the fact that we're playing with someone else is already something to celebrate, that you know, you're joining forces, you're making music together with a friend. In this case, that's our terrific colleague, Otis Murphy, who's a saxophone professor at Indiana University. It has a celebratory nature to it, the piece, and it just really seems apt, after all we've been through, to be able to make music together, you know, but with someone that we wouldn't ordinarily make music with, a saxophone player.
Violist Mark Holloway of Pacifica Quartet talking about their new release, Contemporary Voices. Thanks to Valerie Kaler, our producer of new classical tracks from American Public Media. And since you're clearly a music fan, let me tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, the Piano Puzzler Podcast. Each week, host Fred Child invites composer Bruce Adolph into the studio to play one of his brilliant musical mind games. Bruce takes a familiar tune and he disguises it in the style of a classical composer, and then a contestant calls in to try to solve the riddle. It's a lot of fun. Subscribe to the Piano Puzzler wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Julie Almacher.